Hi, my name's Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. And I would like to thank Bob for the privilege of being included in this conference and being allowed to take the podium with people I've respected all my sobriety and people who I've come to know in my sobriety. And so thank you very much. This is great. Before I get started, there was a Clint Hodges was here last year and gave a wonderful talk, and Louise and I had a chance to spend the weekend with him and Linda. And Clint died in September, and so if we could just have like 5 seconds of silence for Clint, thank you. Thanks a lot. So, I want to thank Ralph for allowing me to take on his financial situation. Always a pleasure. Anybody who knows me knows that I need to get a mirror on my wallet that says funds may be less than they appear. I am not the guy to see for that. I want to thank Bob also for allowing me to speak on steps 5, 6, and 7 rather than sex and fear. Until I started thinking about it this afternoon, and it all boils down to pretty much sex and fear. Everything in my life pretty well distills down to sex and fear. And everything radiates from it. So I really, I think you're in for, I'm like the fish in Mrs. Eisenstadt's pond. My memory is, except for the things that really irritate me, limited. It's not that I don't remember things, but I can't memorize things. In sobriety, I was fortunate enough to learn or to be able to teach English to high school students. And it was I loved doing that. I loved it. And I loved the subject that I was teaching, which was English. And I taught British poetry. And I was talking to a gentleman here from Fresno earlier who was also a teacher. And I love my subject matter. But I can tell you something. I taught Shakespearean poetry for 7 years. And I can't remember or pull up a Shakespearean sonnet right now to save my life, which is one of the great sadnesses that I have about my drinking. Before that I could memorize all kinds of things, and now I just know a little bit of trivia about rock and roll, and that's about it. But when it comes to reciting the big book, chapter and verse, I can't do it. Other people can do it. I admire that and respect that. I can't do it. And likewise, whenever I pick up a piece of poetry that I used to teach and look at it, it all seems relatively new, which is a good thing. So, whenever I read the big book, like for the 40th time, I'm looking at it going, this is good. This is good. This is what, yeah, I remember that. So that's a caveat so that you won't expect me to start quoting. I have had a spiritual awakening of the anecdotal variety, and I will try to share that with you as much as possible. So I'm supposed to talk on steps 5, 6, and 7, so perhaps I ought to start with step 5, which would seem almost normal. Okay. So, here we are at step 5, where we're supposed to read this thing that we've done to somebody else. And as Howard spoke, and listening to Howard, and listening to Ralph, and last night listening to Tom, and listening to Gail's presentation, I'm sitting there leaning out of my seat, because I want to soak in all of this. I don't want to miss one bit of this. And I'm taking it in, and it's just filling me up. Every time I hear any of our speakers, and I've heard all of our speakers who are here before, and I was delighted to see them here again because I soak it in. But then the idea occurred to me about 2 hours ago that I have to speak at 2 o'clock. And it really, I'm so sorry. There's spiritual weight in this conference. Just consider me the counterweight. As they bring you up into the light, I'll help you achieve some humility by bringing you back a little farther into the darkness, if that's at all possible. Okay. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Oh, damn. I don't like the word admitted, eh? Admitting is like a double whammy because not only am I acknowledging that I did something or felt something or took some action that may not have been right. I hate to say wrong. Now I have to admit to another human being. I was raised Catholic, and I always thought that was the Catholic cheat, as far as I was concerned, was that we had to go into confession, which is another word I don't like. They've since changed it to reconciliation. But I kind of like the rubber hose attitude that confession gives you. That and it was supposed to be anonymous because you would go in there and they had the, and I don't know if any of you were raised Catholic. Gee, I wondered in an AA meeting. But you'd wait in line to go into the confessional, and sometimes you'd stand there as I did and wait and wait and wait, and the person before me would be in there for 20 minutes, and then I'd start judging. Filthy, miserable, what are you telling him? Oh my God, you know, my mind's going. And then I go in there to try to confess my own sins. And it was supposed to be anonymous, but they had this beveled glass that the priest sat in the middle, and he'd pull the glass, the partition open, and he'd look at you, and you knew that he knew it was you. The minute he opened that thing, I knew he knew it was me. He might as well have just said, yes, Charles, again. I was the crown prince of impure thoughts at that point in my life. And I carried around, even before I started drinking, all of these things that I knew I felt and I knew I thought. And unlike Ralph, who said that he's not motivated by virtue, I always believed I was motivated by virtue. I loved the good guys. I loved reading. When I was in about the third or fourth grade, I read A Tale of Two Cities. And a guy at the end goes to the gallows for his friend. And I thought, this is exactly the kind of person I'd like to be. These are the people I really admire, the ones that charge into the gunfire, the ones that are always respectful and on top of things, the Gary Coopers of the world, you know, those guys. And yet, when it came right down to it, I have more of a dirtball tendency than I'd like to admit. If I hear gunfire, I go look for someone to help. I'm not the person who charges into a situation because I don't like people anyway. Why muddy it all up by getting involved with them? I just would rather stand back and yearn for a world full of virtue. And as Howard said so eloquently, I'm yearning for this world full of virtue, which even God must yearn for. And do you deliver? Never, ever. Constantly disappointed by your moral weakness, your cowardice, your ferret-faced little infidelities, your casual lusting, your gluttonous, greedy, grubby little mitts. I don't even want to be a part of your species, you know? I had that feeling this morning. They had a listing in the LA Times a few years ago about the symptoms of depression, which were just, I don't remember what they all are, but there were things like longing for death, a sense of mourning all the time, a sense of loss, a sense of grieving, a sense of despair and hopelessness. And I thought, I go through this waiting for a light to change. I went to see, I have, I have two huge defects of character. One is lust, and the other one is procrastination, which sometimes works to your advantage and sometimes it doesn't. But and I bought a book. This is so lame. I mean, I bought a book about 20 years ago on procrastination, about how to get rid of it, how not to do it anymore. And I read about two chapters of it. Then I lent it out to a friend who was a procrastinator, and he wanted to look at it too. And I've never seen it again. I had it for about, before I lent it out, I'd had it for about 2.5 years. And I'm sure he lent it out to someone who saw it on his shelf too. And then it occurred to me that maybe that was the only book they printed of that title, that they just knew that it would get around eventually, because nobody would read it, but they would certainly be happy to buy it and then hand it over to a friend. And my life is built around that kind of reasoning, that instead of actually moving forward and taking on responsibility for things, I would rather go out, and the satisfaction of buying a book on it makes me feel as if I am resolving the problem. You know, if I buy the book and I'm sincere about reading it, and once the money's changed hands and I get home and take it out and put it on my shelf, problem over. Action is the key to my being. And and that's how my life has always been. I mean, forever. I've always procrastinated doing things and being something. And I'm one of those kids that it's like, you know, doing the inventory. 3 months and 2 weeks, 2 months and 2 weeks, 2 weeks and 2 weeks. It's always 2 weeks, but I got mine. I have mine assigned to me at about 9 months sober, and I was told to have it done before I got my first year. And I worked on it day and night for about a week. The last minute, you know, because I don't want to sit down and look at that stuff. I already know what it is, you know. I know what it is, and certainly if God is all-powerful, He knows what it is too. So maybe we can just say, thank you. I'm happy to be sober. What harm can that do? What harm can that do? Rather than going in and having to make things up because I'm not quite as bad as you. Because I always thought I was more virtuous than you. I was the antithesis of Ralph, and yet I understand Ralph to the core, because not only am I his antithesis, I'm exactly like him, except the paths differ and the actions differ, but it's the exact same person. Tom was saying last night, you know, we don't know what we are until we really get into this. And although this is not a journey of self-discovery, which I find to be really, when I hear people say, I'm going into AA so I can learn more about me, I found that going into the program, I received the most benefit when I started trying to learn more about you and try to understand you more. Because the more I did to get out of my own way to get closer to you, I started to find a great relief and release of that which was towing me down. And yet it wasn't I can't focus on what's towing me down. I have to focus somewhere else and allow something else to take charge. And Ralph talked about that perfectly this morning, that once I get out of my own way, I can start to stop fighting the current and move with the current to see where it goes. Because I don't know where it's going to go. I don't know what's going to happen. But rather than cursing the direction of the current and trying to fight going the opposite way and risking getting exhausted and drowning, I've learned through the first four steps that I can actually move with the flow of things and find something that I would have never found if I kept trying to fight it and go back to where I was and go back upstream. The fifth step is important because, like anything in AA, when you talk about it, it's like shortening the legs on a chair. You can't shorten one leg on a chair without affecting all the others. And AA is the same way. You can't talk about step five in a vacuum. It applies to everything that everyone spoke about this morning, and it applies to everything that everyone is going to speak about this afternoon and tomorrow. And so I'm just trying to, I'm tap dancing here, but I, so, and the short is, read it, and then ditch it. Chuck used to say uncover, discover, and discard, but I think in our internet world it's more like uncover, discover, and delete. And the guys know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so I had this. I wrote this inventory, and my sponsor gave me specific directions on how to write it. He gave me a list of 7 questions. That's what his sponsor had given to him. And he said, answer these questions the best you can, but the first thing I want you to put on your inventory is the thing that you were the most certain you would never tell another soul, and the thing that you swore you would go to the grave with. I want you to write that first, and then start writing after that. And it doesn't have to be in any particular chronological order. It doesn't have to make any sense. It doesn't have to have a thematic center. It doesn't have to have a catchy title. It just has to be whatever is happening that's coming up in you to try to get it all out. And as I wrote that inventory, I started to re-experience the stuff that was grinding on me. All the shameful things that I had done in my life, all of the pathetic little, as Clint used to say, nickel and dime compromises that add up to one great big collapse. And I had all these defects of character in there that were just waiting to be identified. I didn't know what they were. You couldn't have told me. If you had sat me down before I did my fifth step and said, or before I did my fourth step and said, I want you to focus on your defects of character, I would never have known what a defect of character was. Because as far as I was concerned, a defect of character was something that you did that made me irritated. You know, that's what a defect of character is. It's your character that's defective, not mine. That's also the gauge of my second step, because when I believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, doesn't mean that I'm crazy or that I get crazy. You know, you hear people all the time from the podium, I'm crazy, I'm just so crazy, I'm going crazy, I think I'm crazy. When I'm crazy, I am the most sane son of a bitch in the room. When I am my most crazy, I am the only one who makes sense in here. See, you're laughing and you don't even get it. You see? And I just get on that. It's that cascading sense of difference that all of a sudden I realize I do have the big picture and you don't. And that's insanity. And I had to, when I would get that way, I'd have somebody like Vince come up and go, hey, you got a commitment here? Well, not yet. Well, then you're going to stack chairs. Go over and do that, you know. And I would take these I'd do what these old timers said, because my sponsor told me you don't ever turn down something that an old timer tells you to do. If they want to get them coffee, go get them coffee. I thought, why should I be going to get some guy coffee? That's ridiculous. I didn't say it. I just said, really? And but I felt it with all my heart. And I would get sent off to go get coffee. And to this day, if you've got a day sober more than I do, I'll get you coffee. It doesn't matter, because I don't care about how I look to anybody. But that's because of what happened before this. And in those days, you were taught to, or at least even today, I mean, there are many, many active groups of Alcoholics Anonymous where commitments to the program, or service commitments, as they call them, in some parts of the country, are the touchstones of sobriety. Not because not because stacking chairs is going to make you spiritual, which is what I see. I want an action with a payoff. I want an action that's part of a transaction. You know what I mean? Quid pro quo. I stack your chairs, you make me spiritual. But I'm not that stupid to think that stacking a chair is going to make me spiritual. You can't convince me of that. You can't convince me of any of that bunk that doing this is going to make me spiritual. Oh, how do you have a spiritual awakening around here? I'll tell you, my sponsor would say, well, come to the meeting tonight and I'll tell you. I'd go to the meeting, I'd find him, hi, are we going to talk? Yeah, we'll talk later. Give me a call in the morning. You know? And we never got the question answered. You got your commitment? You're doing your commitment? Yeah, I'm going to go do it. And you're going to call me in the morning? Yeah, I'll call you in the morning. Okay. Well, when are we going to talk about what gets a spiritual awakening? Well, we'll talk about that. We'll get to that. You know? I go stack the chairs, clean the coffee pots, fold the cords, because I'm not big enough to plug in the cords. I just get to fold them. And I was the be a literature mule. I didn't get to set up the literature. I just got to carry it for the guy with the bad back, get it out of his car, take it into the meeting, bring it up there, and he would say, okay, come back right after the Lord's Prayer. Pack it up for me. And he'd brush me off, you know. And it just, I thought, I'm in publishing. Not yet. I was just working as a receiving clerk at a bookstore. But I am that close to being in publishing. And I would appreciate a little more respect. But I didn't say that. I just said, okay. And came back after the Lord's Prayer and muled it back out to his car. And all these little bitty things just kept... It just seemed like a circus of stupidity around here for me. Because I hear people get up to the podium and go, and then I had a spiritual awakening. And I'm going, wow! But they would never say, because I was too new to hear it. I had a guy who came up to me I was telling Vincent Pat about this the other night, that this guy came up to me the night I got elected secretary in my home group, and he was new. I hadn't seen him at meetings. He was about 4 months sober, and I shook his hand and said, how'd you like the meeting? And this woman in our group who had been a secretary was the speaker that night, and she talked about her complete moral, spiritual, and physical collapse, about the disaster of her marriage, and how she managed to get to meetings and do commitments and make amends to, you know, do her inventory. And she was so nervous she would throw up at meetings, and she would, you know, made amends to her husband and started becoming a mother to her children and got better jobs and became a person who has some integrity and who was actually able to gain the trust as a leader for our whole group. And she talked about that, and she sponsored like 20 girls in the 20 women in the group, and this guy said, well, I didn't hear much about the steps. I said, what? He says, well, she didn't talk about the steps. And I said, she talked about making amends to her husband and her children and writing an inventory and going to meetings and being committed and all these different things. He goes, yeah, but she didn't talk about the steps. She just talked about the things she did in her life. He couldn't hear it. He couldn't hear it. It wasn't that he was a bad guy, and it wasn't that he was stupid. He just was unable to hear it. That's how I felt the first three times I heard Chuck Chamberlain. I was sat there and just... Everybody was on the edge of their seats in the meeting. I'm sitting there with about five other newcomers, and we're looking at each other. And then you'd hear Chuck laugh, and everybody else would laugh, and we'd all look at each other again like we just did not... surrender! And then the one that stuck in my craw was, half measures avail you nothing. You'd think they'd avail you 50%, but they avail you nothing. And we would, what is this old coot talking about? We weren't able to hear it yet because we hadn't gone far enough in the program. What we were doing was still stacking. We were in chair stacking spirituality, period. You have to do that. You can't do it any other way. There's no shortcut to spirituality here, unless you go to rehab. I won't go on a panel again, I guess, for about a year now. But so I had all these things going on, but I didn't know how to articulate them. I didn't know where they were going. I didn't know what was happening with me. But all I knew was if I showed up and I stacked the chairs and I cleaned the coffee pots and I did what my sponsor said and called him, that somehow I would stay sober one more day. Or I came to realize that at the end of the day, not at the beginning of the day. I had no assumptions about staying sober for any day. And then it occurred to me after a while that when I had about 9 months of sobriety, I was looking at the people in my meeting while I was standing there with a mop, and it occurred to me that I liked all of them, and I knew their names. I knew their names. And this is from somebody who does not like people and who does not get it. And I knew all of them by name, and I liked them. Just liked them. Not intellectually liked them. I liked them from down here. And I thought, what was that? And I told Bill about it, and he said, well, you had a spirit. That's a spiritual awakening. You just had to get out of your own way long enough to let God out to play. All you do is keep the door shut. You know, it's like the cellar door. Keep it locked and don't let old Uncle Ed out. And I thought that it was only bad stuff inside of me. But what I realized after I had done all this stuff, this rudimentary, tangible, goofy stuff that sometimes you don't hear about it. In some places, you hear about studying and we surrender by getting on our knees and praying to God, which is fine. That's fine. I'm not criticizing any of that. But I only understood it when I started doing all this other stuff that seemed unrelated to the matter at hand, which was staying sober and trying to achieve a spiritual awakening. And what happened was I got a spiritual awakening by surprise because I'd surrendered myself to a God of my understanding and not one of my expectations. Because I had a God of my expectations, like we all do, the big hairy Viking, that, you know, the cosmic thunderer. You do two bad actions in a row and you are on the list, you know, and you're on detention. And that's how I felt about God. I felt that God didn't answer my prayers. So once I had that experience and I realized, by that time, Bill sat me down and said, once you've had that experience, that moment of understanding God's presence or experiencing God's presence, not understanding it, but experiencing it, that now you're ready to move forward and trust that power that made you have that awareness and that feeling inside. Trust that power to do your fourth step. Don't hold back and don't be afraid. Just don't be afraid. I thought, how can I not be afraid? I'm afraid of everything. I'm afraid of everything. But I put on this sense of phony intellectualism and a big vocabulary to protect myself. Some of you protect yourself with big weapons. You know, that's why I brought my big book up here, not to read from, but to deflect projectiles. But we all come in here with this mask of fear. One of the best experiences I ever heard about it was from Bob, who had some guy carrying, I think he had a tow chain for a belt at his meetings and was packing a knife in his boot and standing off in the corner glowering at people for a couple of weeks. And Bob went up to him, and Bob knows where he's coming from, because I'll tell you something, if you're new and you're kind of confounded why old guys walk up to these really strapping, prison-billed, angry-looking guys and say, "Hi, how you doing? Why don't you come over here and let me get you a cup of coffee?" When you want to say, "Get away from them. These guys mean you no good." But the thing is, I understand another man's fear. And when you start to understand another man's fear or another woman's fear, if you're a woman, then you're not afraid of them anymore. And Bob went up to this guy and said, "You look like a guy who thinks you're pretty tough." And the guy said, "Well, actually I am." And Bob said, "I bet you're the most frightened guy in this room right now." And the guy started crying. And I thought, wow, that's exactly what happens to us when someone finally tells us the truth that gets, and not in a critical way, and not in a way that scares us, but in a way that just kind of slides through all of our defenses. And in the same way, I believe that that's how a power greater than we are, which I believe inhabits me and doesn't live in outer space somewhere and visits Earth when he needs a miracle to do, but that he lives within every single person, that when I do enough things to get out of the way of my own fear, it lets him out. It lets that power out. And then I'm able to experience something that gives me hope and allows me to move into the rest of my life, the next part of my life, or the rest, which could be the next hour, could be the next 10 minutes of my life. So I started on my inventory, and I worked on that for 3 months and a couple of weeks, and got that done, and I had it in an... It was something. It was like... It weighed about 6 pounds. It was in a big manila envelope. I had written on everything, napkins, matchbook covers, anything that came to mind, I would write it down and throw it in there. And I had this big, big package of hurt that was sitting in my apartment. And I called Bill. You know, here's what's funny about procrastination. You do it for months and months and months, and then when you finally get your inventory done, once that pen is off the edge of the page, "Get over here now, I got to read this thing. Now, now, get over here now. You know, I've got to destroy the monster." And I called him and he said, "Well, let's do it next week." I thought, man. He said, "Just take it, take the envelope, and put it someplace where nobody's going to find it. and just let it sit there by itself till next week, and don't worry about it. It's fine. So I took the I'm ready to make a big dramatic deal out of everything, and I put the envelope away. And the next week, he called me on a Thursday morning, and he said, "Be at my house at 5 o'clock tonight, and I want you to have a flashlight with two extra batteries in it, and I want you to have your inventory, and let's go." And so I came over to his house, and my sponsor's car was broken down, as it usually is, and we borrowed this woman named Michelle Addington's car. Michelle was a good member of our group, who's passed a long time ago, we took Michelle's car, and Bill drove, and we drove up the coast to Santa Barbara. We just drove for a couple of hours, and he said, "Just start reading." We talked. Well, it's that uncomfortable small talk you have before you do a fifth step, because you just, you know, "So, how about those Dodgers?" You know, it's just anything to keep from having to dig, to just get in and do the surgery. And we're driving along, and Bill finally said, "Okay, do it." Now, it says in our book that we have to be sure of the person we choose to hear this inventory. We don't have to know them specifically, and it says in the 12 and 12, I think, somewhere that you can even ask a stranger and sit them down and say, "I have something that I need to read to you that will save my life, and I need your help," and read it to them, and that will be the right person. It just doesn't, but I had to, I wouldn't know who to ask. I wouldn't even want to embarrass myself in front of a stranger. You know, I had things in that inventory. I wouldn't sit down with a stranger. I don't want them jumping up screaming and running out of the area or calling the police. So I sat down. When I was newly sober, I'd only been sober about 2 months, and I was going through a divorce for the first time. I'm cataloging them now, but I think I've got it right now. But my ex-wife soon-to-be ex-wife, wanted to meet with me at this therapist's office. And I've been sober 2 months, and I hadn't seen her in about a month. And my head was spinning. And she was purely operating on emotion, as I understood. And she was, and all the stuff that had gone on in our marriage. And now, I'm coming to grips with the fact that I'm in deep trouble, and I need help, and I need to stay sober. And now she wants to meet with me in front of a therapist, and I'm unarmed. I am unarmed. I don't have anything to deflect the raw information I've been getting for the last few months. So I went into this. I was going to go meet with a therapist, and Bill. I told Bill about it. He said, "What are you doing tonight?" I said, "Well, you know, Lisa wants to meet with a therapist in Manhattan Beach," and I was living in Venice. And Bill said, "You need a ride?" And I said, "I don't know. I can't tell you." He said, "I'll be over to pick you up. What time do you have to be there?" And I'll pick you up at 4. And he drove over, and he picked me up, and he drove me down there. And he waited downstairs while I went into that meeting. And AA people really do step up to the plate and he taught me how to do that, because I would not have done that for somebody else. I would have given him cab fare. I would have wished them well. I would have run away. But this guy just came over, picked me up, drove me down there, and waited. And I sat in there, and she talked, and she railed, and she was very upset. And I understand that now. But at the time, I didn't know what to say. And all I kept doing was trying to reiterate what I was doing in AA, and it made her madder and madder, because I wasn't jumping into the argument. I was just saying, "I'm trying to get better. I'm trying to do something with my life. I know I did some wrong things. I don't know what they are yet. I'm still trying to figure this thing out." And she'd get more furious at me. And I just sat there as calmly and as quietly as possible, just telling her, "I can't answer your question. I can't answer your question." Thinking to myself, "Now look who's the crazy one, you know? Go ahead, jump and bounce off the chair about me. I'm not going to react. I'm not buying it. That's what I did our whole marriage." And so I went out of there, and I went downstairs and got in the car, and Bill takes off, and he goes, "So how did it go?" And I said, "It was fine. It was fine." We get about 5 miles, and he looks over at me and goes, "How did it go?" I just burst into tears. I was just completely out of control. I just melted in the car, meltdown time. And so Bill pulled over, and we went in and got a cup of coffee at this coffee shop in Manhattan Beach and sat there and talked. And he said, "You don't have to walk through any of this stuff alone. You're going to be okay." And so when it came time to read that inventory, and I read to people, said that you could just read it to anybody, I knew exactly who I was going to read it to. I knew exactly who, and it was never a second thought. And I sat down with Bill and in that car, and we drove up the coast, and we drove back, and I read that inventory to him. And Man, I relived every single resentment and fear and heartbreak and grief about my separation from God, about my parents, about the way God doesn't answer prayers, about the resentments against people that I knew who were more successful than I were, or who were smarter than I were, or who rejected me in the course of my life, and all the failed romances, and all the ways that I couldn't live up to other people's expectations about, and that just rolled out and rolled out and rolled out and rolled out. And I'll tell you something, that was the last time I ever experienced the pain of any of those things. That was the last time. Because just like the priest that had been in that booth, I was able to tell it to another human being. And when I was done, we had driven all the way to Santa Barbara and driven back. And we pulled in just in time for our Thursday night meeting. And we pulled up in the parking lot and Bill said, we'd finished somewhere before we got to the L.A. County line. And he said, you know what? If you believe in a God that's greater than you are, that you've experienced a little bit so far here, I'll tell you something. He said, I forgive you for anything that you feel that you've done wrong in this inventory. And I forgive you for everything that you've talked about where you felt like you'd been guilty and had done some terrible things. And if I can forgive you because I've done those things, then what makes you think that the power that created you doesn't just completely forgive you like you can forgive any child? Now let's go in and have a meeting. And we went in there and had the meeting. We went out for coffee afterward. And I was a wreck. I was like a husk of a human being. And we go to coffee, and I'm sitting in the booth, and there's like 15 other people sitting in there, and everybody's yakking and laughing and scratching. It was a good speaker, yada, yada. And I'm sitting there in the booth just kind of like someone popped the flash bulb in my eyes every 15 seconds. And somebody said, you're being awfully quiet tonight. And Bill said, Charlie just did his fifth step before the meeting. And everybody at the table started applauding and cheering and said, Corey, and then they all went back to talking just like they had been before. And I felt better because it made me feel like I'd finally done something that I was so terrified of doing that it didn't warrant any more pain. It just warranted, and since that day, and I'm talking about that was in 1982. I got sober in June of 1981, and that was in 1982. And I haven't experienced real pain from any of those things that I read to that sponsor since then, as long as I was able to continue on the rest of the journey. Now, the thing that's really we have two other steps that come right after this. You'd almost miss them if you're reading the big book. It's only like two paragraphs, steps 6 and 7. You can just coast through those. Who needs to do those anyway? Yeah, I got some defects of character. It'd be nice if you took them away. Thank you. On we go, you know. You're God. You can do anything. You made the mountains and the sea. You can certainly take away a little lust problem or a little sense of anger that I have sometimes where I want to just become a sniper. Certainly you can lift that, oh mighty power. Which is, because I thought the hard work was done, you know. And Bill says, okay, go home and you know, tonight, tomorrow morning, I want you to do the 6th and 7th step. Read it in the big book and do what it says. And then we'll move on to the rest. Don't burn the inventory, though, because we need that for later. And you'll hear about that from Vince and Pat. But keep the inventory because that's your list. That's your working list for your next steps. But tonight, just do your 6th and 7th, and that's good enough. So I went home and I did the 6th and 7th step. Did exactly what they said. You know, sat down, read that prayer. Okay. Woo. No big whoop. Get up in the morning. Get on the freeway. Feeling full of, you know, the day after the 5th step, I'm feeling like a whole weight has been taken off of me. I'm on the spiritual plane with God and Abraham and Moses, you know, and Fulton J. Sheen. And there we are, and I'm feeling fine. And then some bum cuts me off in traffic, and I go crazy. I want to have a loaded weapon. And I'm one of those people that wants to chase them down to teach them better driving. You know what I mean? That kind of, this person needs to learn how to drive better. And what am I going to do? Look at me. Look at me. And what am I going to do? Get out with a weapon? Come on. so I'm full of fantasy and la-la, but I get angry again. And so I made a mental note of that. 6 and 7, theory. Don't really work. So I did that for years, a couple of years. Years! Lust would come back up again, and I'd feel like I had to take action. You know, which for me is like a chihuahua chasing a school bus. You know, what are you going to... What the hell? What are you going to do if you catch the damn thing? And but I still... It doesn't mean that I don't have the drive. It just means that I don't have anybody to... never mind. I was going to make a car parking and garage analogy, and I thought that was unwise. But knew that it didn't work, because I'd say that prayer every morning. I would read that prayer during my prayer in the morning. I don't meditate well. I immediately start thinking about my defects of character. Really, I had lust and money and fear of insecurity and all that stuff. But I do pray to God. I take my moments to sit with God and do my reading. And I read that prayer every morning. Every single morning I read that prayer. And I'd say the Lord's Prayer, and ask God to... I'd pray for my friends who needed prayers. And I would say, I'll do your will, whatever that is. Please let me do your will. Then I go out of there, and I get on the freeway. And damned if they're not still there. They just are. It's like they're sitting on the off-ramp waiting until they see my car putting by. And immediately they go into action. And at work they started to do that. And I would get in line, you know, with... I've told this story a million times, but it's a symptom of my personality. I'm in line with the muffin lady. I used to work in this office. By the way, after I started doing the steps and getting into them, I started getting better jobs because my attitude started getting better. So, surprise, surprise, things started happening. Now, that's not a quid pro quo either. You're not going to get better jobs just because you have a better attitude. But it sort of worked out that way, and it was fine with me. But then I started to get kind of cocky and thought, you know, I can be in at 9-ish. One morning I got a little late, and I was in like 9:10. I had to get up to my office. But I thought, I'll be up there in due time. I'm going to get a cup of coffee before I go up there. And I go into this little cafe in the lobby of the building, and I'm standing there, and there's a woman in front of me, and there's probably about 8 people in front of me, and we're waiting, and I'm thinking, come on, you know, why couldn't you be faster instead of me having to leave earlier? And don't you understand, I'm in a hurry, I have things to do and places to go, I'm a sober member of AA, I'm trying to live the right way, and you're just mucking it up. And I'm standing there, and I'm waiting, and finally, you know, it's 10 minutes past, and then finally this lady gets up to the counter in front of me, and the counter guy says, what would you like? And she says, oh, I don't know. I thought, you don't know? You've been in line for 10 minutes. The menu's right up there. You're standing here wasting time. She's looking. She's going, you know, you had a muffin last week that was really great, but I can't remember what it was. And I'm thinking, Pick any muffin. How bad a choice can it be? It's not like you're trying to name your child. Pick a muffin, for God's sake. Here, let me pick this. She'll take that one. Here, take it. I'm buying it. Get that out of here. Don't ever get in front of me in a line again, moron. She turned around and saw there were a couple people behind her. She went, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't know anyone was behind me. And I said, that's okay. That's why I drink. That's why I drink, because that anger doesn't have any control. It has control. I don't have any control over it. And I have these things. We have a terrible condition that we're all in, called human, and some of you are suffering with it a little more than some of us, but and I've come to believe, and I was taught this at a younger age too, that, you know, we have these conditions, and they're mentioned in the Big Book, the 7 deadly sins, they used to call them, although we don't say sin anymore because that's pejorative, so now we say the 7 dwarfs, I guess, I don't know what, but they... The seven somewhat bad ideas. La, lust, anger, greed, envy, gluttony, sloth,
pride.
Thank you. Yeah, easy for you to say. Pride. And those are the seven deadly sins. Those are the innate defects of the human character. Those are the things that we are susceptible to and we fall to. And as you've heard, who we are as people is rooted in how much we can more or less hold off those pitfalls of human failing. That makes us who we are. So I don't have any virtue about gambling. Gambling doesn't interest me. Accumulating hordes of money doesn't interest me. So greed is not a big problem for me. So therefore, it's not a virtue for me either. Being not greedy is not a virtue. Some of us, you know, we look at this list, and some of us have these things, you know, a lot of these things. Some of us, it's like a list of things to do today, you know. And we are more or less how much we resist them. And if you're like me, you don't resist them very well at all, whichever ones I'm susceptible to. I don't resist them at all. Because I am like every other human being on earth. I'm pursuing pleasure and avoiding pain. That's all I want. And when you don't have anything going on inside and you're trying to find pleasure and avoid pain, you don't want to go near those things that are going to maybe show you up as being someone who has flaws. Because I know I've got flaws, see? I already know that I'm defective. Oh, now I need to go through this list and find out more about how defective I really am. Let's just call it a day. And that's exactly why someone like me drinks. Because drinking allows me to find some relief from those things and from the self-knowledge that I have, which is usually way over what God would ever put on me. I mean, we get humble in a very dramatic way sometimes. As I wear humility like a coat of armor, you know. And so when we talk about how bad we are, we're just really bad, evil, you know, liar, thief, liar, cheat, and a thief. I thought, well, I'm not a liar. I twist the truth somewhat, but only to make it easier for you. And I don't cheat, but I've been known to try to cut corners in getting things done, and I'm not a thief. I borrow with the intention of paying it back. You know, Howard talked about that. He didn't steal anything. He just borrowed it until it was more advantageous to bring it back. That's not thieving. That's just making space for other things. But I never thought of myself in those terms. It wasn't a dramatic thing. It wasn't like I was a bad man. I was a, you know, sometimes, and this is really annoying, but I guess I should just say it. Men can't get up here and talk about their sexual escapades without being termed pigs. But a woman gets up here and talks about how many men she slept with, and whoop-dee-doo, it's a round of applause. But I always resented that. I always get irritated when I heard that and thought, you know, I don't know that anything I did was really that dramatically terrible. It's just that it was that soul-grinding, day-to-day compromise of principle that I've been taught by my parents, by teachers, by clergy, by everybody that would work, that I just chose to turn the other way because it was painful to try to live life according to those principles. And once I started drinking, there was no reason to have to do that. I want to thank Bob again for having me. Thank you for being in my life, and I hope for the best for all of you. Thanks. Thank you.